The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I think everybody knows deep down in their bones that these changes are ahead and that we are at the end of the world as we have known it. And there's going to be tremendous emotional turbulence as things unravel. People are going to have to be grounded in some kind of sense of principle or meaningfulness to which they can really be anchored.
That was psychologist Carolyn Baker, the instructor of a new online course offered this April 24 by today's podcast sponsor, postpeakliving.com. This four-week course will teach students how to prepare emotionally for the post-peak oil transitions ahead. Register today at postpeakliving.com. Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to the KunstlerCast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Long Emergency, The Geography of Nowhere, World Made by Hand, and the newly published ebook Big Slide. So Jim, I want to talk to you today about attitude and emotional issues concerning all these issues that we discuss.
Yeah.
But I want to set it up with a little story about what happened to me. I was out at the bar with a very intelligent guy in my community, and we were having a nice evening until he asked me how I felt about this issue concerning the parking garage in our city. There's a big debate over whether the city should sell the parking garage or if they should continue to generate revenue off it, etc.
Is that big thing by the Uncle Sam Mall?
Yeah, exactly.
So-called the urban mall failure thing.
Yeah. Exactly. And I said, you know, my opinion was solicited from me. So I said, well, honestly, I would just knock the fucker down. But this guy got so mad at me over that comment, you know, and I said something more intelligent afterwards. Like I would try to erect buildings that have retail space and, you know, dwelling space above them. At the very least, I would at least shave the parking garage so I could line it on all sides with some active buildings. You know, I didn't just say knock the fucker down. That was the first thing out of my mouth. But anyway, he just got so mad. He was mad at me for the rest of the night. And he was like almost shaking with anger. And, you know, it struck me that these issues are very emotional. But before we actually talk about, and that's what I want to talk to you about on today's show. But before we do, let's just talk about parking really quick. I mean, here's my thought on it. There is just this attitude out there that in order to save your city, you've got to have ample parking. And it is just insane.
It's just amazing how that evolved over the years. And obviously, it goes hand in hand with our unbelievably extreme car dependency. And, you know, it's sort of the way it is. We are now so programmed for this that we can't get out from under it. But you know what's going on is that it's really become sort of the highest and best use in the public imagination for our land. And you could see this in the last 50 years of development history in my little Main Street town of Saratoga Springs, New York, where beginning in the 1960s and 70s, they started knocking down, you know, whole 5, 10, 20-acre neighborhoods and districts. It doesn't sound like a lot, but you could get half of Siena, Italy in some of these urban renewal districts, so-called. But an interesting thing happened. These districts never underwent urban renewal, at least not for a very long time, because what happened after the destruction of the neighborhoods and the blocks is that the citizens in town made an interesting discovery that they actually valued the property more for car storage than for urban activities like buildings and businesses and apartments and things to do and places to live and, you know, theaters or anything else you might have in a city. All of that was valued less than your ability to stash a car somewhere. And it had the strange consequence in our little town of turning a small American town that had some dimension to its center into little more than a Main Street corridor.
Yeah.
You know, our Main Street Broadway became a corridor for about 30 years, on either side of which were these wastelands of parking where people were expected to store their cars and then go to the main street and go to their restaurant and, you know, go into a boutique. But then you return to the wasteland of parking, get in your car and drive back to, you know, Worcester, Mass, or Albany or Montreal, wherever you've come from. And then, you know, some other strange things started to happen. One was that we actually did go through this phase of redevelopment. It got started really quickly in the late 90s. I don't actually have any idea whether I had anything to do with it, with my books, The Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere, because at the time, in the late 90s, I was pretty heavily involved in promoting new urbanist ideas. But, you know, it seemed to me that these were ideas that were just spreading like a meme through our society, and not just because I was trying to promote them in my town. But as it happened, a lot of the developers in my town got the new urbanist bug, and they started building buildings in places that had not been built upon for 30 or 40 years. And we started to get, you know, 4, 5, 6-story buildings with apartments in them and retail on the ground floor. And all of a sudden, whole new streets were coming back to life. And it was a pretty good thing, all in all. The architecture wasn't great, but the urban design was quite good. You know, if you will allow me that distinction for the moment without going into a huge explanation about the difference. Okay, so that brings us up to the early 2000s, okay, in the 21st century, and a weird thing happens. For some reason or other, the voters are pissed off at the Republicans, and a Democratic candidate comes along, this lady whose name I'm actually not even going to drag into the arena, because what I have to say about her isn't very nice. But, you know, I'm a registered Democrat, and she was a Democrat, and she ran as a putatively progressive Democrat, and she gets into office. And one of the first things she does once she's the mayor is to announce that she's now against any further redevelopment of the center of town, because it's come to her attention now as mayor that too many people are complaining about that the parking spaces are disappearing and being replaced by buildings. Oh my gosh, what a crime. We're redeveloping the center of our town, and the parking is getting, there are fewer and fewer parking spaces. And of course, it's still, you know, there is absolutely no problem parking 3 blocks away from the heart of downtown and walking 3 blocks to get there. But nobody wants to do that. Everybody wants to park, you know, 63 feet away from the main street. So the upshot of this all is that, the mayor, who was supposedly a progressive, took a really pretty vehement stand against further redevelopment of town because the citizens still are programmed to value parking more highly than any other activity that might occur at the center of town. So it's so weird, but it's still the case. And, you know, until we are manifestly in deep, deep trouble with motoring and with buying cars and making them happen, you know, the public attitude is probably going to persist and continue to be a problem one way or another.
Well, a common expression that comes up in these debates is, you know, no one comes to downtown Schenectady or Saratoga for the parking. You know, they come for the attractions, the buildings,
and,
the
you
businesses.
Know, the leaders among the new urbanists themselves have for years made the point that the best places in the world are the places that are the hardest to drive around. You know, you go to Perugia in Italy, you know, a wonderful town, and you actually have to park, you know, outside of the town and either, you know, walk in or they have actually a very strange kind of escalator system that you can take up to this sort of elevated butte where the town really exists. Or, you know, going to Siena, Italy. You can take a car into Siena, Italy. I once did it. Back in the 80s, I drove a very awkward and pretty large, considering it was Europe, Alfa Romeo, rented Alfa Romeo into Siena, Italy, and it had an extraordinarily stiff transmission, a standard stick, you know? And I get in these situations where I would have to make 137 little micro turns and going back and forth, like, you know,
my girlfriend parallel parks anyway without.
Oh, well, I use the Braille method of parallel parking. You know, where when I feel the other guy's bumper, I know that I'm parked successfully. But, you know, getting around Siena, Italy in a car is just madness. And then having to just, you know, stash it. And you never want to see the fucking thing again, you know, while you're there.
Yeah, I mean, listeners from Europe email me sometimes. They think that we're crazy talking about these parking issues. And
yeah.
Because they send me photographs of all the cars in their city parked on the sidewalk. Which is another whole problem, too. Like, their cars are just blocking the sidewalk.
But, you know, this parking dementia that has gripped the United States for all of our lives, you know, for at least half a century, probably more, you know, it's got to be understood as an absolute dementia. You know, it's a group psychosis, and we're going to get over it, but, you know, it's going to be a little bit hard, and there's going to be an overhang of psychosis, even when things are manifestly changing.
Yeah. Well, a couple more thoughts on this. I got to thinking, you know, if you surround every building in your city with ample parking, all you do is create, it's Jevons paradox all over again. You just create more of a demand for parking, because your buildings are now too far apart to comfortably walk between. Therefore, people are going to want to drive between each building. So therefore, you don't just need the parking to accommodate all the cars in your city at one time. You need the parking for eight times the number of cars.
Well, yes. And you're describing, I think, a self-reinforcing feedback loop, you know, which, you know, starts with a problem and then ends up generating more of its own problem as it goes along. Yeah. You know, I saw a slightly different variation of this, though, which was it was equally insane, but it was actually about a different kind of an issue in a way. About, I don't know, 8 years ago, I was living in a house with my then wife that was too small for both of us to have a home office. So I had an office on the second floor of one of the buildings right downtown, in the heart of downtown.
Right.
And at the time, something really cool was going on. After 40 years of having this UFO strip mall on the site of the old Grand Union Hotel in the center of town, an adventurous and valiant developer decided that he was going to put a major building there and get rid of the stupid strip mall. So that got underway, and there was this major building that, you know, a 4 or 5-story building went up on Broadway in Saratoga. And it was sort of a great victory for the town. It was a wonderful thing. And so I go downstairs one day, and I meet the father of a kid who I know in town who's a college student. And his father is a Skidmore College faculty member, right? And the father sees me down the street, and he starts this conversation about how he's pissed off that they've built a new building on the main street because it is now obstructing the view of the church that's halfway down the block. You know, and I asked the guy, well, are we supposed to have a view of every monumental building in town from everywhere in town? Because if that's what you want, we shouldn't have any buildings in town. You just have like 4 buildings, you know, within like a half a mile, square mile, and the rest of it will just be flat so you can see those 4 buildings.
Isn't that what Washington, D.C. looks like?
Well, it's sort of what Las Vegas is like, you know, or you know, most, it's what every big box highway pod looks like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's absurd. So anyway, there's a great misunderstanding also, I think, among the public that city life is about views. You know, it's about scenery. I had another strange experience in that vein. A few years back, I was giving a spiel at a college in Spokane. And Spokane is on a very dramatic site on I think it's the Snake River, but I'm not sure. Maybe it's the Spokane River. But it's a very dramatic kind of river gorge system. And the city is down on mostly on one side of it. Anyway, I was picked up at my hotel and taken on a tour by the city planning guys from Spokane. And what I realized after the first half hour was they were taking me to one place after another outside of town on the bluff across the river and looking at the views. You know, and for them, the whole city experience was about views. It was about viewing the city from a distance. And they never did get around to taking me downtown or down to the to Spokane proper that day to actually be on the grid of streets that compose the city of Spokane, Washington.
Yeah.
But, you know, it made an impression on me because I realized that for so many people, the whole issue is about views. And it's not. I mean, that's... People don't go to Paris because of the geography. I mean, maybe they go up into the Eiffel Tower, you know, and maybe they go up to the Butte of Montmartre and look down at the city. But it's not about views. It's about your experience on the street. It's about what's 20 feet in front of you and what's yeah. what's at the end of the block where the vista terminates. And, you know, that's what the experience of being in the city is about.
And you really can't get that experience with ample parking. But here's another thing that happened to me recently. I was in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is one of these hip little bohemian towns. You ever been there?
Northampton's a very good town, you know, by American standards. It's a pretty good little Main Street town, sort of on the Connecticut River. And there's the Smith College is there, and Amherst is nearby, and the U of Massachusetts is nearby, and Mount Holyoke is nearby. So it's drenched in... you know, collegiate verve and activity.
Yeah, and it's got tons of restaurants and theaters, everything you could ask for.
A pretty good main street. It's got a good music scene.
Yeah,
and it's got some really nice residential neighborhoods. And also, it's in a lovely part of New England.
Yeah, I'm going to discuss Northampton again on another show. When we talk about hipsters, which we'll talk about at some other time, Jim, because there's an awful lot of hipsters.
I'm not hip culture. Enough to talk about hipsters.
But here's the thing. Northampton, I only went there once. I'm going to have to go back. I'm definitely going to go back again. But even though it's this great pedestrian-friendly, lively little city that has more restaurants in a square mile than some big cities do because they're so busted up, the car dominates this city.
Yeah.
It dominates.
But the main street is very, very wide, as I recall.
It's like Saratoga Springs wide.
It's even wider, I think.
It might even be,
huge.
Yeah. And it's not as extreme as I'm about to explain, but there is ample parking in Northampton, Massachusetts. And, you know, the main street was fairly complete as far as the buildings, the streets.
There aren't too many missing teeth there.
Right. But then... As soon as you get off that main street, there's all these little parking lots. So it's not like your teeth got pulled out one, every other tooth got pulled out, but it kind of has.
This is where the molars are in the back there.
Yeah, and I kind of got this feeling like, you know, if that's what it takes to get, you know, like Troy vibrant, I don't know if it's even worth it. Because I love the 19th century fabric of the buildings where I live, and it's fairly complete. And it's almost like, God, if you got to do that. I don't even
know. Well, I think that was the former programming, and that's what we would have done, you know, if it was still 1995 there was some prospect that you know, we were going to have enough money in the economy to do something like that. I think there would be a big fight about providing parking. But I think now we're in a very strange transitional time where we're clearly headed into another different phase of American history and of American life, and things are not going to be the same. But we can't really see where that's taken us yet, so you're not seeing much action on the ground. I don't think it's a terrible thing that there's no action at the moment, because probably what's called for right now is to just do nothing and wait a little while.
Yeah.
It's not going to be very long before we're going to get in trouble with some kind of a, you know, yet another oil crisis, or, you know, a period of scarcity or supply problems or price problems. We're already having problems with other elements of the happy motoring scene. You know, people can't get car loans the way they used to. It's not as easy to get money to buy a car. The municipalities are having trouble fixing the streets because they're so broke. So there are all kinds of things that are now militating to kind of put an end to the kind of happy motoring that was normal. And I think we'll eventually see how it alters the scene in some of our cities, so that, you know, we're going to remove the parking requirements. People are going to shut up about militating for it. And we're going to see a lot more densely conceived and executed redevelopment.
Well, that brings me to the main entree of today's topic, which is talking to people about this and the emotions involved. I mean, I think what you're saying is these towns that have good infrastructures, not great parking, need to just hang tight for a little while.
Exactly.
But there are still politicians in these towns that want to knock everything down and pave it over because they think that's the only thing that's going to save their town. So, and it's not just politicians. It's a lot of people who care about this stuff. So I find, like, I was having a discussion about this the other day, and the person I was talking to just got so angry with me for having a different viewpoint on parking. It seems like the tempers flare an awful lot. I don't know how to go about talking to people. I probably shouldn't have said knock the fucker down with the parking garage, but we were in a bar. I wasn't being too serious, you know? What do you think, Jim?
I think it's going to be a kind of a threshold or critical mass kind of event or process. You know, there's that old saying from, you know, the philosopher that new ideas are first greeted with ridicule, then they're violently opposed, and then they're accepted as self-evident. And I do believe that we're in the middle of that process now, and that we will soon emerge to the point where it's self-evident that we shouldn't fill our cities with surface parking or structures for parking, because, you know, it'll be self-evident that the future is not about motoring. People will get it, and they'll get it very suddenly. And they won't even notice that 9 months earlier, they thought that motoring was going to be the determining factor in how we did everything. They won't even know. They'll, you know, just one moment they'll wake up. One day they'll wake up with a different idea because, you know, it'll be obvious. And there'll be something about the hive mind, you know, the collective termite consciousness of mankind in its North American version, you know, where they'll get it. This idea will spread with the force of a powerful subconscious meme, and everybody will realize, oh yeah, that's right. We don't need that parking anymore because we're doing things differently now.
Right. Okay, but Jim, let's talk about the emotions for a minute. I just attended a talk of yours a couple of weeks ago, and you weren't actually debating anyone. You were just giving a presentation, but you got pretty riled up there during your talk.
Well, I hadn't done one of my university style talks for a couple of months. And I was sort of coming out of the gate, and there had been various things that were pissing me off, over the ensuing several months. So I hadn't been in front of an audience for a while. And, you know, there's a lot about this that is riling me up lately, especially the idea that people think we're facing voluntary lifestyle changes. It's really just a matter of, this week I'll be green. You know, next week I'll be a vegan. The week after that I'll be a bicycle advocate. You know, that it's all just lifestyle stuff. I don't think people really understand the forces of nature that are coming down on us that are going to really compel us to do this stuff differently. And these were people who call themselves stakeholders in the community, so many of whom were ostensibly, in a community leadership role of one kind or another. And I wanted to make sure they understood how urgent these issues were, that we really can't afford to, there are a lot of things we can't afford to do and to be right now. We can't afford to be denialists. We can't afford to be crybabies. We can't afford to be distracted by stupid sideshows. We really got to get serious about meeting these challenges. So I sometimes get pretty ticked off. But of course, there are some audiences, though, that just propel me into mad dog mode.
That wasn't happening here because you were just...
But sometimes, you know, people will ask me stupid questions or make some stupid comment. And you know, then I really start losing it.
Well, okay. I mean, everyone, I get angry myself. I think everyone, people care about these issues a lot, whether they're on one side or the other. They do care, yeah. Right? And, you know, I get angry too. But the question is, like, how do you think it's valuable to get angry, or do you think it's important to be diplomatic?
Well, it depends what you're doing. What I'm doing is I'm basically putting on a show. And a lot of what I do is for dramatic effect, very mm-hmm. consciously, you know. And in a way, I am making a conscious effort to sort of act out the kinds of emotions that I think any sane audience member ought to feel about these problems. You know, that we are doing things that are so fucking stupid that, you know, the only sane response is to be angry about them. So to some degree, I'm you know, acting out emotions that I hope people... I don't want people to start carrying flaming torches down the street, but I do want them to feel deeply about the damage that we've done to our landscape, to our towns. I want them to feel deeply about the fact that we're capable of doing better and we must do better, that we can't afford to do such lousy work anymore. We can't afford to surround ourselves by things that are so disheartening and depressing and dehumanizing. I really want to push them emotionally to a point where I'm really kind of shoving them into an uncomfortable position. So, yeah, a lot of that is, you know, conscious rhetorical showbiz effect.
Yeah. But do you think that in general, so you're doing it for showbiz effect? But
yeah, look, you know, I'm not a person trying to negotiate with a planning board member, you right. know, trying to swap and trade, you know, political capital with some other politician. I don't have constituents. And in a way, you know, that's a virtue for me in my position is that I don't have clients, I don't have constituents, I don't have to really be that careful about whether I offend people or not. I mean, one of the more offensive things that is out there right now is the truth about the situation. You know, the fact that we have made ourselves into a nation of overfed clowns who are incapable of behaving intelligently to even save our civilization. And, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing to accuse people of that. You know, I think it's necessary. I guess what I'm saying partly is that I really truly believe that shame is a great motivator and is an underused and underappreciated device for inspiring people to behave differently. And one of the things about American behavior in my time is that it's been so shameless. You know, we put up all these terrible buildings and people should be ashamed that they allowed their community to do this. And that and the developers themselves should be ashamed that they were the ones who invested capital in putting up something that disgraced the town. And the members of the planning board and the mayor and the council members need to feel ashamed about the terrible choices that they've made. So I actually think that it's a good thing to provoke that kind of feeling in them and to not let them get away with escaping it. You know, you really need to sort of pin that responsibility on them. And also give people in the community the idea that, you know, if you make the same bad choices or ones like it, then you're going to be subject to the same kind of shaming as these people. So let's all do something better, something that we're not ashamed of, something. Let's do things that we're proud of.
But I have witnessed some misdirected anger and emotion at some of these town meetings and charrettes and things like
that. Well, emotions can certainly get out of control. I mean, that's the story of the human condition.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's either, you know, you're fighting with your neighbor or you're lobbing missiles into the neighboring country. So, you know, it's everything from a household spat to war to a disagreement in a planning board.
Now, I sometimes frequent urban planning websites and discussion boards. I can't remember where I read this. It was either Cyberbia or Planetizen or Arch Boston or whatever. There's all these sites, right? But there were some urban planners complaining about JHK copycats. In other words, people who've read your book or listened to your talk, and then they try to show up to their planning board meeting and they start busting out with this heightened rhetoric and
well, I can't be responsible for that. I do what I do, and it's you know, it's more successful or less successful depending on, you know, what I'm doing at a given time. And
right.
But, you know, a lot of those people are probably not doing it just because they're trying to emulate me. I'd be inclined to think that a lot of them are doing it because they're ticked off and passionate in their own right.
Oh, yeah.
They have their own personal, legitimate feelings that they've developed quite on their own. Because, look, the stuff that's in our towns today... you know, I'm not such a special being that I'm the only one who feels bad about being in the presence of these terrible environments.
Yeah.
You know, it should be probably normal for most people to feel bad in and amongst the kind of things that Americans have built for the last 50 years. So, you know, I would think that it would be an almost a universal condition for people to be walking down the street being pissed off at the stuff that they're, you know, that they're surrounded by.
Yeah, I mean, these people might not have ever even read your books, but the
sure.
people on this discussion board were kind of just attributing it to your style in one way or another.
Well, I've been doing it in public for a while, so, you know, I can see how maybe I'm identified, you know, that people identify it, that kind of angry response with me, but I'm certainly not the only person who feels that way.
Do you adopt a different approach when you actually do attend your town planning board meetings? I know you've gone to the Saratoga Springs City Planning Council before, right?
I don't know. Sometimes I'm, you know, kind of low key, and sometimes I get into mad dog mode. We have had a lot of characters coming before our boards. You know, developers. In some cases, you know, really evil out of town developers, like those villains from the Pyramid Corporation in Syracuse. And by the way, there really is a company in Syracuse called the Pyramid Company. They were big mall builders in the 1970s and 80s, and they built one of the original malls in Saratoga that was later bulldozed and replaced by yet another mall.
Yeah, I think the head guy of Pyramid lives in Skinny Atlas, where malls are outlawed by zoning.
Yeah, right. Robert Congell, the head of the Pyramid Company. And they're behind, of course, this new folly in Syracuse, one of the biggest shopping malls ever built. It's going to be called Destiny.
Yeah, because of Destiny. The NY.
Actually, you got to see it visually because it's Destin with NY on the end in capital letters like New York,
yeah.
Right? And the whole idea of this insane project, which was conceived just before the collapse of really the banking system and the real estate industry, the whole idea was that you'd attract bazillions of customers from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Worcester, Mass., and Montreal, and God knows where else, to come and buy sneakers in Syracuse, New York. Now, what kind of a stupid idea is that? Now, of course, the idea, you know, looks even stupider, and you know, is just standing there being nakedly stupid for all to see, because there's no way that people are now going to drive from Scranton, Pennsylvania to buy sneakers in Syracuse, because people are so broke and they have no jobs anymore and their houses are being repossessed and they don't have money to spend in the mall, and they're certainly not going to drive 150 miles to buy their sneakers somewhere else. So, you know, this fiasco, I think, is still under construction. What the rumors I've heard, I haven't been to Syracuse in a couple of years, but the rumors I hear is that there's some construction underway, but they've sort of halted it in the meantime while they're digesting the damage that was done to the economy and what it means for the true destiny of this project.
Listeners, if you Google it, I think you can find some architectural
D-E-S-T-I, capital N, capital Y, Destiny,
yeah.
Syracuse, New York.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
So even right there, Jim, like if you were actually at a planning board meeting, say—
So yeah, these guys came into the planning board 15 years ago, and they wanted to site a Walmart in a particular place. And we actually won that battle. We sent them packing. Yay. But, of course, they're relentless, you know, so Walmart eventually came in another site over the city of Saratoga border in Wilton, and they built it in Wilton.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. You beat them in your own turf, and they go right to the edge of town.
And now, you know, we've developed this kind of cancerous tumor zone of big box shopping 3 miles north of Saratoga. But I'm enjoying watching the spectacle because I think that that is going to fail spectacularly. That whole exit 15 of I-87, where all of the big box shopping developed north of Saratoga. Now that we're entering the commercial real estate shakeout, it's going to be interesting to see what happens up there.
Yeah. Well, I don't. To wrap up this whole thing with the emotions, I don't. I feel like people criticize you sometimes for saying that you get too angry, and that sometimes you can even get mean. But on the other hand, people on the other side of these issues get angry and mean right away. I mean, this guy the other night just called me essentially like a more. You're not living in reality. You're. I don't know if he called me retarded, but it was like out of nowhere. It was saying I'm pretty much a moron for suggesting anything other than erecting parking to save our city.
Well, there are strong feelings all around on this. And my guess is, just because I think it's in the nature of things, that when a society does enter a period of difficult transition, that the thinking and the feelings get more extreme and possibly even kind of highly irrational, as the distress mounts. And this is we are, despite what people think about, you know, Barack Obama and the whole idea of change, the fact is that, you know, Barack Obama aside, we are entering a period of very visible and emphatic change in the way we do things in America.
Mm. Well, Jim, one final thought on this. After my conversation about parking in downtown, I said, you know what, I'm going to go on Google Earth. I'm going to take a screenshot of above the mall, the main mall in our area, which is Crossgates Mall. And then I'm going to take a screenshot of downtown Troy, for example, at the same height. I know this is not totally scientific, and I'm going to try to copy the shape of the mall and all of its parking accessories, and I'm going to plunk it on top of downtown Troy to just see the size. And I got to tell you, the mall is roughly the same size as the downtown.
Right. You know, as I said earlier, there was an urban renewal district just behind our main street in Saratoga for years and years was just an empty wilderness of parking lots. And you could have gotten, you know, half of Siena, Italy one little urban renewal district of a small town.
Yeah, but the thing that they showed me, I mean, most of the mall is, at least half of the area I copied was just parking lots, right? Surface parking. So therefore, there's nowhere in downtown Troy that you would have to walk farther to get to than you would if you were at the mall. Now, granted, some of your walking in the mall is in air-conditioned environs, but come on, the parking lot is like half the size of the city.
Well, it's a perception thing. And of course, a lot of it has to do with the nature of the journey that you're making and the character of it. And if you're making a journey across a wasteland of surface parking, that is perceived as being pretty unpleasant.
I know. And yet people prefer to do their shopping at the mall than downtown. Not everyone, but a lot of people do.
Let's face it, the commercial attractions themselves have left the centers of the city.
Yeah, it's true. I see. Well, what I was thinking about, though, in this debate, maybe without me screaming and yelling, it's a web idea, but I would like someone, and I've approached a few people to make this, to create a website where you can type in your address or your city's name, and then it will plunk the main mall on top of your city just to create that visual that I did on Google Earth. So if anyone's listening out there, you want to work with me on this, it has to be a free project. I don't want to charge
money
for this.
Isn't that what the GIS guys do?
Sort of like that. I mean, in Google Earth or Google Street View or whatever, is just using
I know a guy
GIS.
Who could do that in this area, Todd Fabozzi.
Yeah.
Who works for the Metropolitan Planning Org in Albany. And he's actually the one guy that I've ever met who actually knows how to use GIS in a way that really tells a story correctly.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see this as just a little website, you know, for the whole country. You just plunk in your town and it does that to you.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll see if I get this done. And folks, if you're listening, if you have any ideas on how to help me with that little mission, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, I got to go to the parking lot and get my car now.
I'll see you later, Jim. You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.